Okay, well, for once, I cannot say that it's a pleasure to be here. I wish the occasion was not, you know, was not what it is, but it is an honor to speak in honor of Joe, a great honor. This picture is not Joe's picture. It's a picture of some of his work taken from nature. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some of Joe's work on string theory vacua, and some recent work I've done on that subject by the end that's relatively precise, but a lot of the talk will be review of various things. And I'd actually like to begin not by talking about string theory vacua, but by briefly describing Joe's impact on my thinking about physics more generally. So here we have pictures of two objects that I associate with him most. One is a picture of the Fermi surface, and we heard from Sung-Sik Lee why that might be something you associate with Joe. And another is, of course, the picture of D. Ransom. So the first work of Joe's that I encountered was actually at TASSE 1992, when he was a vibrant young person. I remember he was a real demon on the volleyball courts. And I remember he yelled at me for always hitting the ball to the same place because the opponents had no trouble getting it. But anyway, at that time, 2D gravity was all the rage, and Joe had done central work on that subject, and I showed up at TASSE expecting, like all the other good little string theorists, that we would hear about 2D gravity from Joe. But he shocked me, and I think the rest of us, by talking instead about non-Fermi liquids. And he wasn't serious, but he was a very competitive guy, and he joked that if he could solve ITC, he would get a fancy chair just as good as Weinberg's. He was at Texas at the time. Now, ITC, of course, remains unsolved, but Joe did get his well-deserved fancy chair and much more. And it took me something like 20 years to get to the level of maturity where I could really appreciate the works he told us about in 1992, but by 2013, I did actually find some time and ability to work on that subject and did some work of my own on non-Fermi liquids, and Joe's thinking was really the central guide. And although by then he had moved on to the paradoxes of black hole physics and was talking about firewalls, he was kind enough to send me remarks every time I would ask him questions about the subject, and they were very helpful. Now, but of course, as for all of us, another guiding piece of Polchinski-ology was the discovery of D-brains. They changed my work in life in 1995 when they played a role in engineering field theories out of type 2 strings, and they've played a starring role both in my life and many of the people, the life of many of the people in this room ever since. And it's important for me to stress, and this is one of the things I admired most about Joe, that I could go on and on. You might think that he's a string theorist, he did a lot of work on string theory. Well, no. I started with him with non-Fermi liquids. He had a beautiful take on the renormalization group. He worked on singularities. He worked on holography and central papers we may hear about from Matt and others. And it goes on and on. And Joe was one of the greatest examples in my life of somebody who made it clear that physics is not something where you pick a little subfield and become the world specialist, but it's a unified whole, and you can think about all the subjects, and your knowledge in one may inform your work on the other. Okay, so that's my pie into Joe, or my ode to Joe, but let me transition now to my talk proper and discuss his work on string compactification. Now, Joe wrote many technical papers on string compactification, on orientifolds and vacua with tensor multiplets in six dimensions and all kinds of forbidding sounding subjects. Though he was not, by and large, a fan of fancy mathematics, I remember once we got to see him react to someone describing D-brains as objects in the derived category. And it kind of looked like he was drinking curdled milk. So in keeping with that spirit, I'll talk about his very simplest insight into string vacua, which came out of his beautiful work with Raphael Busso. So here's a simple action. There's an Einstein term. There is a negative cosmological constant. And there's a four-form flux with some coefficient z. And then there might be brains. What Joe and Raphael realized is that the extra dimensions in most of the constructions string theorists talk about are a complicated place. So if you Google Calabi-Yau and hit images, you get lots of complicated pictures. Here's one that I kind of like. It has a bunch of holes.
Actually, you get that picture 100 times.
Did you make this picture, Dave?
No. Okay. Stephen Wolfram made it.
I see. Okay. What they realized was these spaces have interesting topology. They can have many cycles, through which you could thread a flux, just the same way a magnetic field line can thread a solenoid. And as long as the fluxes were of the form I wrote before, but contributed incommensurately to the energy, so they have different values of the z, they don't all line up with integral quantization, you can tune the cosmological constant starting from that negative lambda bare. It's basically a problem in lattice theory. You try to get a point in the lattice of the fluxes whose length squared is close enough to zero. Okay, and so this is not a PhD in number theory kind of question, and they answered it pretty clearly. So under mild assumptions, Busel and Polchinski argued that if you start with a bare negative CC and consider a model with roughly hundreds of distinct cycles threaded by a flux, and that hundreds is not something they picked out of the air or to get an answer, that's because if you go and look at the heroic catalogs of Kreuzer and Skarka, of the kinds of topologies many string theorists use, you'll find the number hundreds. Okay? So with these conditions, and with the assumptions they made, you could fine-tune the vacuum energy to attain very small positive values in their admittedly very toyish toy model. Okay, and one of the things their very toyish toy model did not really explicitly deal with is the problem that even the simplest string compactifications have moduli. So here's a torus, here's the tau parameter of the torus, takes values in this famous keyhole region, which actually played a crucial role in many of Joe's own papers. But let's put that aside. Okay, if you put that aside for a moment, their work gave us a qualitative picture of a universe that on large scales would have vacuole with accelerated expansion, and bubbles of new vacuole with accelerated expansion popping up within those bubbles, and further bubbles within bubbles. That's not this picture. This is André Linde's famous picture of eternal inflation, but this is easier to understand than the bubbles within bubbles within bubbles. Okay? And Joe was the first to say that their picture was in keeping with the same admittedly very imprecise pictures that come out of the studies of inflationary theory. Okay, and in fact, Joe used to refer to this picture as the Lindeverse. Now, let's try to get slightly more precise, okay, and this will introduce notable complications, which remain subjects of debate to this day. So if you turn on fluxes in string theory, in a gravity theory, everything back reacts. You can't turn off the gravitational interaction unless you want a free theory. Okay, and so, in particular, the fluxes back react on moduli. And unless you're really careful, if you try to find a solution, various things could happen. If you start with a Ricci flat manifold and just turn on fluxes, well, fluxes, like a B field, contribute positively to the energy, right? The Maxwell energy is E squared plus B squared. That positive energy can relax in an easy way by making the theory become free, either decompactifying or going to zero coupling. And so you either end up, in the simplest examples, with decompactification, or you end up in anti-de Sitter space if you do this famous clever thing that Freund and Rubin did, where you play off the tendency of positive curvature to want to shrink against the tendency of flux to try and want to make the curvature, you know, the curved space large, because that would minimize the flux density. So many of us were thinking hard about this already in 2001 at the workshop Avatars of M-Theory, and the result for me personally was immensely important. This was probably the most important 6 months in my career so far. It was collaborations with Steve Giddings and Joe Polchinski. Here's Joe. I think this is one of his famous D-Brain lecture pictures. And with Herman Verlinde, who's here. And I started a long, long, long-term collaboration with Sandeep Trivedi, who happened to be at KITP. And remembering just this one workshop has always brought home to me what an important place KITP is for our field. And of course, what an important person Joe was in my own career. So let's talk about string compactifications with flux. One starting point, the one that's reasonably common in the literature and that I thought about with Joe, was type 2B strings on an orientifold of a Calabi-Yau manifold. You take a Calabi-Yau threefold, you find a Z2 action or something, you take the quotient, there are O planes at the fixed points. There are other ways to generate such models, but that's an easy one. And the effective theory you get out of those in four dimensions looks like the following thing. The 2B theory is interesting because it has two different two-form potentials, one for strings and one for D-strings. And so there are two different three-form field strengths, which you usually gather together into a G3, which is a complex three-form. And the effective theory has a superpotential, which wedges that with the holomorphic three-form of the Calabi-Yau. This may look like a number, but since omega varies on Calabi-Yau moduli space, this is a function of the complex structure. And then there's a Kähler potential, which, you know, normal tasteful people who work on supersymmetric field theory don't talk about. But here it is, it comes from dimensional reduction. And the important point here is that in addition to the complex structure of the space, the volume will play some role. Okay, and it appears in this precise way, which is something that we understood. And the result of that precise form is that at leading order in every possible expansion, which is where I'm talking, the tree-level supergravity is of a very special type called no-scale supergravity that had been discussed in the 80s by supergravity theorists. The existence of O-planes here is crucial and was one of the things that was really hammered home in this workshop in 2001. And the result is that when you find solutions of this tree-level theory, tree-level in all expansions, you end up with solutions only when V is zero. No-scale supergravity means that if there's positive energy, because of the e to the k in the supergravity potential, there's a 1 over rho cubed, you decompactify. So all solutions of the tree-level theory have vanishing cosmological constant. Now, in the 80s, people, for about 5 minutes, thought that was super exciting. But, of course, you know, there are going to be corrections here. There'll be corrections immediately. You can't explain the vanishing of lambda that way. So the picture after this work, it was at least in my head, that I did with Steve and Joe, was a low-energy effective theory where this superpotential gives a potential to the complex structure moduli. But always there is this volume modulus of the no-scale structure hanging around. In addition to V equals zero, the special structure of these supergravities guarantees that this field has a flat direction. It's not stable. But there are still D-brains in the problem in general. There could be D3 brains. There are almost always these things called D7 brains. They're common in F-theory, which is one source of these models, wrapping various cycles in the compact geometry. And you would guess, and you would not be wrong, that dynamics on brains could lead to further interesting dynamics. And now we get into a zoo of variants. So everything I say from here on out for the next 10 transparencies is tasteless in the following precise sense. It depends on arbitrary details. So I will tell you some tasteless things that depend on arbitrary details. But at least I realized that. So here's one very interesting variant. You could add anti-brains. The word anti here, you know, of course, charge and minus charge, you get to choose what's plus. The word anti here is chosen because these objects preserve the opposite supersymmetry of the compact space. So whatever you did with the compact space, these would break supersymmetry. And if you introduce a number, p of these, with g string p small, so you're in the opposite of the Moltisanor regime, okay, then they are treated as probes. They move around in the geometry, they respond to the fields, and they have parametrically small back reaction. In particular, in the non-compact confining throat geometry, one of the ADS duals of QCD, studied by Klebanov and Strasser, you can stick these things in and ask, what do they do in this confining QCD-like theory? And the holographic interpretation is rather interesting. They actually describe vacua that have metastable supersymmetry breaking. There are some moduli left, but they're compact Goldstone modes. They're Goldstone modes that live on a sphere. Okay, and so small further corrections, if you have a compact moduli space of Goldstones, you understand what they do. They'll do very little, because here's the picture. You have a Mexican hat potential, there's a Goldstone. If you tilt this picture by a small amount, controlled by a small coupling, what happens is the flat direction is lifted, and there's some discrete points left where the Goldstone would like to live. Okay, so other than those Goldstone modes, in this non-compact approximation with a very small number of brains, that's what the probe approximation gives you. This argument that if you have a compact moduli space and small corrections to it, you get stable vacua is one I just made in words. It goes way back. If you look at the first examples of dynamical supersymmetry breaking in the early 80s, the ones that are not really calculable, this is the way they made their arguments. Now, in a compact setting, where you don't just have this beautiful solution that Igor and Matt found, but you have, you know, this region that's described by their geometry, but then you have a Calabi-Yau space whose metric you do not know, that you're somehow gluing it into, things will change. I argued that the tree-level solutions in this particular supergravity that Steve and Joe and I were looking at was a no-scale supergravity with vanishing energy and a radial mode. And you can quickly determine by scaling, which is always the way Joe thought. He didn't think in supergravity or in the derived category. He thought by scaling arguments. The scaling arguments tell you that this anti-D-brain energy would lead to a rapid decompactification. It would be some powers of 1 over the volume. Okay? So in the presence of no-scale structure, adding such objects would be disastrous. You'd get 10-dimensional flat space. But of course, the no-scale structure is not exact. This is what destroyed it as a potential solution to the cosmological constant problem. There are different ways that it's broken. It's broken by alpha prime corrections to the Kmar potential. And here's a paper by my thesis advisor that I had paid attention to in 1996, called Non-Perturbative Superpotentials in String Theory. It's also broken by those kinds of effects. So a few years later, with Kalosh, Wende, and Trivedi, we thought to use these effects, or their analogs in strong dynamics, which also exist, which aren't quite described in the same way, to stabilize the volume. Okay, and the result was a picture that looked like this. Here, sigma is the radial part of the volume modulus. So you see there's a nice minimum. And maybe if you added antibrains, you could get a picture that's a little bit lifted in energy and could have positive energy. Okay. So this work that we did, and in fact, the first person I gave a draft of this paper to was Joe. He was at Stanford for a Weizmann-Stanford workshop in 2003. The first thing he said before looking at the draft was, you can't do this. There's a theorem because of the Maldacena-Nunez theorem. And then he looked at the paper and thought for a couple hours and said, yeah, no, it's fine. We didn't invite Juan to the workshop. So this work and the work of Silverstein and of these gentlemen and of Dennis and Douglas and of many others supports the modern picture, for what it's worth, of the string landscape. Here's some comments. Okay, this gets back to my tastelessness comment. Okay, the details of any of these constructions are historical accidents. They can be varied. When you describe the N equals 4 field theory, there's a good chance that up to describing a choice of group, you know, there's a unique object. That is not true here. And that's an important part of what's going on. The reason that there is such diversity in the claimed set of string vacua is because of the tastelessness, that there are a large number of varieties of ingredients. There isn't a unique thing. Okay, and so as opposed to things with 32 or 16 supercharges, you have to make arbitrary choices, and those choices lead you to this diversity. There have been criticisms. I wouldn't have talked about this, except it's been a big subject in the literature recently, and it was worked on by Joe in 2015. So it's appropriate at a Polchinski conference to talk about this. Furthermore, one of the things Joe enjoyed most, though it seemed bizarre to me since I hate conflict, was arguing with people, even in the literature. I remember the relish with which he described his fight with Lee Smolin in 2006. I don't remember what they were fighting about.
Oh, come on, we all remember what they were.
Okay, so here's some criticisms. Anti-brain back reaction. You can tell from the words what the criticism is. You add an antibrain, it back reacts, the world explodes. I'll just quote Joe, 1509-05710. This is based on work he did actually with many young people in just before Christmas of 2014. And in fact, he sent me a draft of their paper as a Christmas present. Effective field theory is a powerful tool for analyzing brain back reaction. The result has stood up well. Indeed, perhaps they're 10 to the 501 vacua instead of 10 to the 500 because the result stood up a little better than he thought. The most recent analysis by people, not Joe, by Van Riet et al. Van Riet is one of the experts in Europe who's really spent a lot of time thinking about this. They're in a complementary regime to where I think you should work for the easiest answer. But anyway, their abstract concludes we recover the results of Verlinde's paper. That's from 2 weeks ago. Okay, so I personally don't see that criticism has much force, but I'm sure there are people who differ, and I'd be happy to talk about it. Okay. Are you allowed to incorporate non-perturbative effects? What KKLT did was use results on non-perturbative superpotentials. They're corrections to a Kmar potential. Why can you use non-perturbative corrections to a superpotential if you don't know the exact Kmar potential, which is perturbatively corrected? Well, we're all physicists. The first thing that we learn when we're done with exactly soluble systems, you know, there's the Earth and the Sun. We solve for the orbit. There's the Moon. Oh my God, maybe the solar system's unstable. There's the Moon. Well, the Moon is a small mass. You do perturbation theory. Okay, so the answer, which may or may not lead to the result you want, is that you look at the results delta K, the changes in the Kr potential around the vacuum you're claiming to exist based on our best knowledge of what this is, and you can show that the effects of such a shift will be small precisely if the tree-level superpotential in the construction is small. Now, whether that's possible or not is, again, something that's a precise mathematical question. It's about tree-level string theory. You can study it mathematically. And this was done beautifully by Dedef and Douglas, and I'm happy to explain the results to anyone who wants to know. They're explained in this paper that I wrote a few months ago. Okay, the third and last thing I'll mention is there's a this anti-D3 thing, it's like a zombie. You kill it and it comes back, right? So now the hand is grasping from the grave. The anti-D3s are fine, but if there's a 7 brain, maybe that explodes because of the anti-D3. So this paper appeared a few months ago. It was widely discussed. It gives scalings of energies inconsistent with Randall-Sundrum-Warp scalings. It gives inconsistency with holographic interpretations. It fails macroscopic consistency tests. The author is actually a good friend of mine, so this was stated politely. Out of a sense of duty, because Joe is no longer here to protect me, okay, with McAllister and Zeman, I'll go through this and try to explain why this is true. Now, I certainly believe, see, I've been defensive here, but my excuse is Joe has this 2015 paper. But I certainly believe we could improve our understanding of de Sitter constructions. In fact, some great young people are working on that now. But to quote Joe, there are some objections to the use of effective field theory at all in this landscape context. It's not clear why it should fail in this particular context. In some cases, it simply seems that the result is undesired. This is from his 2015 paper. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about that. Now I want to talk about progress in string compactification. Here I veer deep into territory that Joe would have disliked. Okay, so I personally think that to better understand the landscape, or whether it's there or what it looks like, we should systematically improve our understanding of the mathematical physics of string vacua. Joe would not have liked that phrase. So we've been taking some small steps in this direction in the past couple of years, and I'll describe some of our results. Here's a question you could ask. I talked about Calabi-Yau compactification. What is the Calabi-Yau metric? You might think that's an important ingredient when you compactify on a Calabi-Yau space. Well, there's a theorem due to Yau proving a conjecture of Calabi. This is stated imprecisely, and Dave here can have a heart attack. On M with vanishing first Turing class, there is a Ricci flat Kähler metric for each choice of the Kähler class.
I would just say a unique
Ricci flat Kähler. Fine, unique. Okay, and this is a picture of a statue in Yao's hometown, so the Chinese people at least appreciate this.
It's the same picture, by the
way. Okay. We don't have any idea how to determine the metric on a generic compact Calabi-Yau. But I have recently proposed an analytical technique to get metrics on smooth K3 surfaces, which I will tell you about very briefly. It'll be a cartoon. This was work done with Arnav Tripathi, who's a very gifted mathematician at Harvard, and with Max Zeman. Max happens to be on the job market, so although Arnav is very bright, Max is a true superstar. You should all definitely hire him. You should hire him now. In fact, you should stop watching my talk and email him an offer now. But actually, all kidding aside, Max is super. Okay, so here's a particularly nice class of K3s, largely specified here for convenience. You describe K3s in elliptic vibration. This is famous in F-theory. So there's an equation, y squared is x cubed plus x plus a constant. But now, because the elliptic fiber can vary over a sphere base, there's a function of the coordinate on the sphere base, z. Okay. So to describe our idea, we're going to take a detour. The moduli space of a 4-dimensional n equals 2 supersymmetric field theory has both Higgs and Coulomb branches. Okay, and this has been an object of really intense study since about 1994, starting with the work of Seiberg and Witten. So the rough picture you might have in mind is there's a Coulomb branch spanned by scalars related to vector multiples by supersymmetry, and at some points in it, maybe Higgs branches shoot off where charged fields get Zverev, and Higgs is some of the gauge fields. Gaiato, Murrah, and Nitzky, starting in 2008 in a series of 4 or 5 papers that total something like 600 pages, which is why it's important to have students working on this subject if you're going to work on it, okay, considered this theory on a circle. So these theories on R3 times S1. Summarizing their work is extremely complicated, so I'll do a cartoonish job here. What they said is the Coulomb branch becomes a hyper-Kähler manifold. In 4 dimensions, it's complex. For the simplest case of SU2, it would be a 1-complex dimensional space. But if you compactify on a circle, you get a Wilson line of the gauge field. You can dualize the photon in 3 dimensions. That gives you a fiber over the old base Coulomb branch, and you get a hyper-Kähler manifold. And GMN are actually able to determine the metric on this hyper-Kähler manifold. Okay, and roughly their idea is the following. You get some metric from dimensional reduction starting from the 4-dimensional theory. And their claim is that BPS states which run around the circle, which intuitively are the important new ingredients that you get, the 4D theory had BPS states, they can now give you instantons by running around the circle. Those will correct the metric. And it's not as easy as it sounds, because the BPS states can have all kinds of bizarre charges. They can have both electric and magnetic charges, so they could be mutually non-local. But they give some beautiful formalism for summing the correction to these BPS states and getting what they claim is the exact metric. Now, a particularly interesting 4D n equals 2 theory can be obtained as follows. For those of us who are old enough, you remember the discovery of the little string theories. These are theories that are annoying enough not to be field theories. They have string solitons and a Hagedorn degeneracy, but they're not local field theories. They have an ambiguity in their stress tensor. One particular such theory can be obtained as follows. You take the M theory picture of the E8 cross E8 heterotic string with two E8 walls. You stick a 5-brain in between, and you take a scaling limit, where the resulting theory has 1-0 supersymmetry and is 6-dimensional and has some exotic global symmetries. Compactify that theory, which is a 6D theory with 8 supercharges on a torus, gives you a 4D n equals 2 theory. That 4D n equals 2 theory has a compact Coulomb branch of vacua, which in the simplest case is 1-dimensional. And looks like a sphere with some marked points. Okay, in fact, what it looks like in a dual picture, you can dualize this whole construction to a picture where there's a D3 brain in F theory, probing an elliptic K3 surface, whose equation I drew before. That equation makes clear, if you look at the degrees of the polynomials on the base sphere, F8 and G12 are degree 8 and 12, if you look at the equation delta equals 0 to see where the discriminant of the elliptic curve degenerates, where you get singularities, you'll find 24 points. Unless they coincide, then you get more interesting structures. So these are these 24 marked points, which could collide to give singular fibers. And so you have a 3-brain moving around on this P1, occasionally whacking into one of these singularities where there are light electrons or more exotic matter if the singularity is more complicated. Now, if you compactify this further on a circle, as I said, you dualize the photon, you get a Wilson line. What actually happens is the entire K3 becomes visible. So the moduli space of this theory, of this probe 3-brain, okay, compactified on a circle, is a K3 surface. And the GMN construction applied to this, you have to prove that the instanton sum should converge, should give you the metric on that hyper-Kähler manifold, the compact K3 surface. Okay. I'm pretty sure that Joe would be really disgusted that I'm trying to use D-brains to compute a metric on a Calabi-Yau, but not quite as disgusted as he was about the derived category. Okay, so as an example of the kind of result, and this is a result that was well known for years, the K3 metric in a large complex structure or semi-flat limit is given by this kind of explicit formula. Okay, so this is just here because I feel guilty talking about math without a formula, so here's a formula. Okay, here tau is the complex structure of the fiber. The UAs are the marked points on the base. There's 24 of them in general. And here's the explicit form of the metric. Okay, that semi-flat metric is known to mathematicians. The world line instantons coming from the 4D theory, the BPS states running around the circle, correct that to give a smooth Ricci flat metric on K3. If you do approximations, as I'm wont to do as a physicist, where you just keep the lightest BPS states and say, what would these give? Keep the lightest electrons between each 3-brain and 7-brain. What kind of correction do they give? They actually give something very analogous to an ansatz that Martin Gross and P.N.H. Wilson in the math literature have discussed. Okay, it's not exactly the same, but it's very similar. All the important parts are the same. But the BPS states of the little string theory, if you include all of them, would systematically correct that to give an exact smooth metric. Okay, in my last few minutes, I'm going to change subjects. Okay, so that was about metrics on K3. Now I'm going to ask, can we learn global facts about the space of vacua? Okay, and let me try to explain my motivation, because I'll only be able to say very little. In the days when people often gave landscape talks, you would see this picture. I have no idea what this picture means. I don't know what the red things are, or the green things, or the yellow things. What the hell is this? Okay. So what you'd like to do to answer that question is give some mathematically precise description of what the set of vacua are and what are the relations between them. And that's the moral answer to what that picture means. So I'm going to change the problem to an easier problem, but I guarantee you it's a close relative. It's, can we learn global facts about the set of attractor black holes on a Calabi-Yau manifold? The sense in which it's a precisely analogous problem is the following. Attractor black holes are BPS states. In the 4D n equals 2 theory, you get out of a Calabi-Yau. The way you find them is you take a central charge, Z, which is Q wedge omega, where Q is the charge of the black hole. In the appropriate string theory type 2b, the way you make the black hole is you wrap a three-brain on a three-dimensional cycle in the Claudiat. The charge is a three cohomology class. If Greg Moore were here, I would have to say something about K-theory, but he's not. And Z is Q wedge omega. Okay, if you were not, you know, yet asleep when I talked about the flux superpotential, that was G wedge omega. The problems are mathematically rather analogous, they're not the same, but this is in some sense a warm-up problem. There are some remarkable facts about the solution to this problem for a very, very simple case that are already interesting. That very, very simple case is four-dimensional vacuum with n equals four supersymmetry. Okay, and they follow from something called Kudla-Mielsen theory in algebraic geometry, which I was taught by one of my collaborators. I'm not going to try and summarize that here in my 2 minutes, but I can mention a simple result which gives you the sense of what I mean by global. Okay, the claim is the attractor black holes on K3 times T2 are fully governed by a Mach modular form discovered by Zagier. This is a function z of q. It's a modular form. Q is e to the 2 pi I tau. The coefficients of the nth power of q are hn, and these hns have an independent definition as something called Hurwitz class numbers. Very roughly, there's a correspondence between the black holes on K3 and binary quadratic forms, and these hns determine the number of binary quadratic forms of a given discriminant up to equivalence under SL2Z transformations. So they're a natural object in number 3. Okay. That actually, so yeah, these class numbers count the number of uduality inequivalent attractor black holes with entropy squared given by the discriminant n. Okay, and this is, although from Strominger, Vatha, and other things, you're used to seeing modular forms in black hole counting, this is a very different kind of object, right? We're not counting states of single black holes by picking out these Fourier coefficients. The Fourier coefficients here are numbers of distinct attractors at different points in K3 moduli space. So the nature of the formula is quite different. It's not explained, in this particular case it is, but in general it's not explained by world sheet computation in some obvious way. Okay, so the modularity is still a little mysterious to me. So this is a shadow of a deeper result that attractors and also flux vacua in these very simple models are automorphic. What I mean by that is the loci in moduli space where they live are components of a homology-valued automorphic form. This comes out of Kudla-Mielsen. And I'd like to believe this is a precursor of a deep structure that might exist also in Calabi-Yau threefolds. So extensions to those, if possible, I hope would give us global information about full sets of black holes and full sets of flux vacua. This is a far cry from making sense of the Lindeverse or of Joe's picture, but it's a start, and it's a start where I feel there's some tractable work to be done. You know, so everyone else has shown a nice picture of Joe at the end of their talk. I thought about this yesterday, and it just didn't seem appropriate to me. Joe had a profound influence on my life. I don't think I can summarize it with a picture. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
First a comment. I had a long running debate with Joe about whether he knew math or not. I would always claim that he did, and he would always claim that he didn't. Hmm.
I have the same debate with lots of people, but usually we take the other, the other positions.
I have two comments about things you said. The first is that the this extracting of a K3 metric from these things, that was actually at the base of the work of Koncevich and Sobelman, which kind of interacted with the Guido-Moronitsky work in some way. And the other kind of related remark is that the Gross-Wilson ansatz that you mentioned is identical, I believe, to the Green-Shapir-Vatha-Yau.
It's one step up. So what it actually is keeping the lightest electron. If you want the Ogori-Vatha approximation to the metric, you reach 7-brain. The way it differs from what you get out of this is Gross and Wilson cleverly glue those together with some analytic techniques that don't come out of the physics. Okay. But what I think they also didn't know is the completion by adding these higher DPS states. Thank you.
Clifford.
So a comment and a related question. I don't think Joe would have been as horrified as you suggest, because if you may have forgotten that actually Joe was, I think, the first person to show explicitly using D-brains that you could derive a metric on a hypergalar manifold. And there's that beautiful paper where he implements the whole D-brain as a probe idea and you know, does it in the neighborhood of a Z2 point and then shows that you can get the ALE metric. And there have been generalizations of that. So back then, people were conjecturing that wouldn't it be interesting if you could use that to essentially glue together a bunch of these local patches and derive the metric on K3, and a number of us thought about it and then didn't really know how you do the gluing. So in that language, is what you're saying essentially progress on how to do the gluing between the different?
Yeah, so your question interacts in a beautiful way with Dave's. So this Gross-Wilson paper I cited is exactly doing what you said. It's doing the gluing. It takes 24 local singularities that give non-compact hyper-Kähler manifolds, but Gross and Wilson are really powerful guys, so they managed to glue them together with an exact formula, which is not a Ricci flat metric on K3, but is a nice metric with various nice properties. And my claim is the little string manages to do the gluing completely, and at every point in K3 moduli space, there is a little string that gives the metric on every single K3 surface.
Yeah, I wanted to make a couple of comments about our work on brain bug reaction, which you didn't mention. So one is, first is in the same regime as you are studying, so she's string P less than one. So one is that we found that there is a tachyon when you have many brains, the bug reaction of the anti-brains. So they don't go together, but there is a tachyon which is in half in between in the direction of the circle and in the radial direction. So I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, my comment is that would be a version of what I said about when you have the circle of vacua and there's a correction to it. So the Goldstone modes are roughly the circle of vacua, they're actually a sphere. And small separation there and even small separation in the radial direction could happen from small corrections. What can't happen in the probe approximation is a large change. So I think that my picture of the tilted hat is very analogous to your statement that maybe if you have three together, they split a little bit. Do they do something else?
Yeah, but it's not in the circle. It's also in the radial direction.
It has to be a tiny effect suppressed by powers of P over M, where P is the number of brains and M is the large flux quantum number in the throat, because there's a systematic expansion around the probe approximation. So my only claim is everything's a small correction in P over M. The mode in the radial direction was gapped at weeding order. Small corrections in P over M can at most move you up by a tiny order P over M correction to that large gap. This is the statement that if you have a very massive field in quantum field theory, not a small correction, you can at most shift it a little bit.
Yeah, because, well, the other comment is about precisely this gap. So what we showed is that if you really take into account the work factor, when the anti-brain can destabilize, unless there is a lot of flux on the F3.
I believe that's in keeping with my statement that the small parameter is P over M. I think the
that's
values
right.
of M that you need, I believe that's in keeping with my statement that the small parameter is 1 over M. The amount of flux, and the amount of flux that you need is well within the range you can get in tadpoles and calabials, but as I understood you've said, not in a toroidal orientifold T6 mod Z2. And I agree with that. It could be that T6 mod Z2, which allows 16 units of flux, does not allow this. It also doesn't allow confold singularity or a Klebanov-Strasbourg solution, so the discussion is empty in T6 mod Z2.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Any other discussion? Okay, great. Let's thank Prashant again.